Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. I.C. Smith. And he's written a fascinating book. It's called Inside. A Top G Man Exposes Spies, Lies, and Bureaucratic Bumbling Inside the FBI. And Mr. Smith was a former special agent in charge. He spent many, many years working in the FBI. He's retired. And this is a fascinating insight into so many of the problems in the FBI. And there are an awful lot of good people and wonderful people in the FBI. Of course, we always tend to point out the things where something goes wrong, but we very seldom point out where things go right. And of course, Mr. Smith is certainly not one not to admit that there hasn't been an awful lot of bungling and spies and lies and all sorts of things going on. And here you find a first-hand impression of so much of what Mr. Smith lived and the impressions and the things that he was involved with during his years in the FBI. Thank you so much for being with us again tonight.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. It's a real pleasure.
Well, let's get started on one of the stories. One of the stories really involved an FBI agent here in California who was having an affair with a Chinese spy, and it appeared that the last thing we heard, they were going to let her go off scot-free because the FBI would not turn the certain records over to her or let her get information from her former lover. What was that incredible story about, and why would the FBI be having the agents who were having extramarital affairs with communist spies?
You know, Dr. Spann, this is still a very perplexing story to me. And there was actually two agents that were apparently having an affair with this, Katrina Leung. The code name of the case was Parlor Maid, at least that was her code name. I knew one of the agents reasonably well. I knew the other one less so. And the one in the San Francisco, Bill Cleveland, I was familiar with him. I had great respect for him. His father was even a well-respected, high-ranking FBI official. And I would have never dreamed that he would have been having a personal relationship with a source, and much less one who turned out to perhaps, you know, she certainly was charged with originally having provided information to the People's Republic of China. It's just an incredible story, and as I look at it, and I've talked about this in my book, of course, is that what I found has happened is a lot of the rules that we have in the FBI are there for a very good reason. They're there because people violated these rules and stuff like this. In the case of J.J. Smith in Los Angeles, who was actually charged, he had a whole career that was at the exception. For example, you know, most of us are transferred several times in our career. He spent his whole career in Los Angeles. He was a guy that was allowed to not wear a coat and tie to the office, like most of us. You know, a coat and tie used to be very much part of an FBI uniform. He was allowed to meet his source by himself. And he was allowed to take this source to social functions, including the FBI social functions. And so you go on and on and on, and you find that he was allowed to conduct his day-to-day activities, whereas 99 9/10% of the FBI agents wasn't allowed to do it. That led to, of course, the fact that he appeared to be providing this woman with very sensitive information that
hold that thought right there, please.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Mr. I.C. Smith, the former of the FBI. And so he's just telling us about this incredible instance in Southern California where an agent is not required to follow along with any of the normal protocol of the FBI. He's involved with a woman. Supposedly, she's a source of information, but in actuality, she has been charged with being a spy for Communist China. Even more incredibly, of why he was bringing home classified information and intelligence, and she was copying it and supposedly shipping it off to China. And will you pick up the story there?
Well, and really, this is kind of what was happening with this thing, and finally, he was exposed, and he was charged, and she was charged. But one of the things I make note in the book is the fact that it appeared to me that the government would just really wanted this case to go away because of the way it was being handled. And basically that's what happened, because one of the things, of course, in our criminal justice system is that the defense, in this case, is Katrina Leon. She has the opportunity to have access to the prosecution witnesses and what have you, and the government disallowed, according to the judge. The government would not allow the defense team to have access to J.J. Smith.
And, of course, it would have been a very simple thing to allow them to talk to him, you know, and then they could have proceeded with the trial. And by refusing to do that, they're going to have to let this woman, if she truly is a communist spy, they're really going to have to let her go. That doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make a bit of sense. And this is one of the extraordinary, appalling things about this whole story, is that there's no real justice. Even J.J. Smith, after he had committed all of these egregious acts, and I go through them, you know, through in my book there, all of the violations that he did, and he was allowed to keep his pension, and basically received a misdemeanor, kind of a slap on the hand, and it looks like that that she's not going to be charged because the judge throughout the case. Now, I understand that the government's going to appeal it, but they're going to have to change the way they've conducted this investigation if they're going to really have a chance for prosecution.
And so, you know, after looking at the whole case and knowing all about it, it just doesn't quite make sense. But don't you think that sometimes a lot of things happen that just don't quite make sense? I mean, you'd like to think there'd be a logical explanation, but it certainly is elusive.
Well, you're absolutely right. Of course, one of the things that's happened dealing with China, it goes across the political spectrum from one administration to other, is that for whatever reason, we have had this practice almost of looking the other way when
China... Hold that thought for just a moment. We got to bring that... Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Mr. I.C. Smith, formerly with the FBI, and he was simply talking about this case in Southern California where an FBI agent was carrying on a sexual liaison with one of his sources, who was actually a communist spy. He was providing her with information. She supposedly was relaying it to communist China. He gets off, you know, by violating every rule and protocol and, you know, in the FBI for all intents and purposes, with a slap on the wrist, a minor misdemeanor, and gets his pension and gets to retire. And the communist spy is given almost like a get-out-of-jail-free card. The Justice Department refuses to do anything logical in the prosecuting her. They refuse to allow her to talk to have information from Mr. Smith, which they have the right to under our legal system. And by so doing, the judge throws the case out, which means that the communist spy, if she really is one, will go free. And, of course, although Mr. Smith points out the Justice Department is appealing the case, things don't look very good for us. And as he was pointing out, lots of times things don't make sense. And he was beginning to tell us a little bit about sort of the attitude of successive administrations, whether they be Democrat or Republican, towards communist China. Would you like to pick up that thought?
Yes, you know, if you go back and you look at the history of our dealing with the Chinese, going back from the time that we basically told the Taiwanese that they were no longer going to be representing, you know, the true China, and it would be the People's Republic, But there's been a whole series of acts that have occurred over the years, and you could talk about like Tiananmen Square. You can deal with things like when they one of their jet aircraft rammed into one of ours in international water, in the international airspace, and forced it down on that little island. Even if you go back and look at the Cold War during the time of the Soviet Union, how many times did you see where the United States would show pictures of spy type of microphones and things like this that would be caught in the in the American embassy or around American embassy in Moscow? And one of the famous ones involved a bug that they had placed in the State Department seal in an ambassador's office in Moscow. We've never seen anything like that dealing with China. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how inside of China, of course I had traveled there, is how they are violating our, you know, not only ever diplomatic protocol that there are. You know, they're opening our diplomats' mail, and they're almost certainly violating the sanctity of our embassy there, and no one seemed to raise a concern about it.
Now, that is very, very strange, and you have to ask yourself, why do we treat Communist China so kindly? Why, after the slaughter there in Tiananmen Square, did we extend most favored nation treaty status to Communist China so we could increase trade with them? It really doesn't make sense, but then there are a lot of things that don't make sense. We won't solve them tonight, but I share your concern. Now, you have another wonderful story here, and you were deeply involved with that, and that was about a communist spy who was working for the CIA, and the CIA didn't want to admit that they had a spy working for them, and they held off doing anything to investigate it until finally, they were more or less forced to at least ask for your help, and then they really didn't give you much information, and within a very short period of time, you knew who the spy was. Why don't you tell that story?
Yes, this is the story of Larry Wu Tai Chin. In many ways, it's perhaps the most damaging case that against the United States, of even more so than Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen and what have you, because if you look at the almost probable sheer number of people that were killed because of his information. Briefly, he was a Chinese national inside of China during World War II, started working for the army, actually. And in 1948 or so, he was up in Shanghai, and of course, when the communists took over, he was working with the American embassy there, or the consulate, rather. And then he moved on into Hong Kong and Okinawa and places like this, but by this time, he had already reached an accommodation with the Chinese intelligence service. Of course, he later on received his citizenship papers, and he was basically given clearance to see virtually everything of any consequence in our government as far as the secret's concerned.
And he was working for the CIA all this time.
That's right. He is employed with the CIA, and what was interesting about it, they basically gave him this highly, you know, secret access. And you really can't conduct a background investigation on him because you can't go back into his village in China or something like that to conduct it.
Yeah, but of course the thing was there were lots of signs and you know that he was an immoral sort of individual. Wasn't he carrying on all sorts of extramarital affairs and taking trips to China and all sorts of things that should have raised all sorts of red flags? And the people in the CIA, these top-notch spies who are protecting America, didn't have any idea who the spy was.
No, you're absolutely right, and he was a chronic womanizer. His personal life was just terrible. He was a gambler, and what actually he was doing, for example, one of the more egregious things that he was doing is during the Korean War, the United States, the United Nations would capture the Chinese army prisoners, and some of them would be convinced to go back into China and work for us. Well, he was involved with the debriefing of those prisoners, even though he didn't have any clearances. And, of course, he was providing the identity of those that they were being reinserted back into China, and, of course, they were being killed. Later on, the same thing happened. He had access to the things like the Paris Peace Accords, the U.S. position at the end of the Vietnam War, as we were trying to negotiate a peace accord there. And what he was doing, again, is he was providing this information to the Chinese, who, I guess, were giving it to Vietnamese, and, of course, that just extended the war. And one of the most galling thing that he did is when the United States was a negotiation with normalization of relations with China itself, he had access to the information basically in the Oval Office of President Richard Nixon. And he, of course, was passing that along to the Chinese as well. Extraordinarily damaging. He was finally caught, though. And one of the interesting things about him, that case, and there again, it's one of the first time this has ever been revealed, is in my book, is one of the, you might say, the partners in crime of his whole spy network was a Chinese spy in New York who was undercover as a Catholic priest. And, of course, when we finally arrested Larry Wu Tai-Chien, and he was tried in court in Alexandria, Virginia, and convicted, and a few days later he committed suicide.
But the incredible thing was, first of all, the CIA couldn't find this man, and but they held off doing what they should have done, and that was letting the FBI know so they could have investigated it. And once you got the information, why, it didn't take you hardly any time at all to come up with who the spy was. And yet all these brilliant people in the CIA had no idea who the spy was.
Well, that's exactly the case. I can still vividly remember receiving that little scrap of paper with just a few lines on it. It was basically something along the lines, and there was a remarkable source in this, and I referred to him as Plainsman in the book. That was a code name that I gave him. But Plainsman had reported that you have a spy in your midst. He's been a spy for a long time. And then later on he added, he says he was supposed to be flying back, but he missed there was a flight delay. And so we used that flight delay out of New York and going through customs and what have you till we finally identified almost certainly who it was, and then we found out at that time he was already retired, but he was still passing sensitive information to him. So it was just basically good old police work that allowed us to identify who he was. And then, of course, we then went on into doing the wiretaps on him and the surveillances and what have you. But see, we really couldn't arrest him immediately because Plainsman was still inside of China. So we had to wait till Plainsman was that we were able to get Plainsman out of China before we could arrest Larry Chien.
And then what really amazed me was that after all, when you went in to search his home, and you wanted to arrest him, but you didn't have a warrant, and they weren't going to give you a warrant, and this guy would have flown the coop until finally somebody in the FBI said, I've forgotten who it was, but finally said, if this man gets away, we're going to accuse you of, almost complicity, allowing him to escape. What was that all about? Who was it who just was not going to allow you to arrest him?
Well, this is an interesting time in for the FBI and the Department of Justice because this was the 1985, the year of the spy, they call it. And so when they went in there, and he actually made admissions. And so the idea was that we would arrest him for espionage. Well, we talked to the prosecutor. His name is Aronica. And he said, no, we're not going to do it. So finally, one of the fellows that had used to work for me, his name is Ken Schiffer, he basically says, listen, he says, if we walk out of here, there's no way that we can keep an eye on him with our limited resources and things like this. And if he gets away, as almost certainly he will, it's going to be on your back. Well, that when he saw that, Aronica saw that this potential, escape. And this is right after a fellow named Edward Lee Howard had gotten away down in the Southwest and gone into the Soviet Union. So when Aronica heard that it was going to be on his back, he then authorized the arrest.
And, of course, you had him pretty well dead to rights at that time.
Oh, sure.
Well, so why was the prosecutor doing everything he could to avoid arresting this man? That doesn't make sense either.
It's just a lack of what I would call a aggressive, prosecutable type of a stance.
And, of course, the one thing was that this man should have been executed as far as I'm concerned. Instead of that, of course, he was given, a life sentence, and then, of course, he supposedly committed suicide there shortly after he was...
That's right, it's suffocation in a jail cell.
And, of course, the other interesting part of that story was the Catholic priest, who was really a communist spy, and he was, of course, going to help this fellow get away. And, well, we'll get to that when we get back here in just a moment. There's really so many interesting and fascinating stories. It's sort of like watching television, only it's real life. We'll be back here with Mr. I.C. Smith. His book, Inside, a Top FBI G-Man Exposes Spies, Lies, Bureaucratic Bumbling Inside the FBI. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Mr. I.C. Smith. And, of course, we're talking about this one very, very famous case where, of course, here's one of the most important spies working right at the very heart of the Central Intelligence Agency, and they have no idea who it is. And they really don't give the FBI hardly any information at all. And they're able, of course, within a relatively short period of time to determine who the spy is who's been working for the CIA for almost 30 years. So, but basically, of course, there was this other man. He was he was posing as a Catholic priest. Was he really a Catholic priest who was really a double agent, or was he a false Catholic priest? Do we know?
Well, he was a false Catholic priest. His name was Reverend Mark Chung. And the Chinese had done a very, very good job. He had worked as a Catholic priest for at least a decade in a lot of the South Pacific Island nations, and kind of building his credibility and stuff like that. And finally, he was inserted into the United States, came over as a Catholic priest, and was working in New York.
No, but did the Catholic Church have any idea he was a communist agent?
No, certainly not. He was at the Church of Transfiguration in Manhattan. And but then, of course, when Chen got arrested, he immediately flew the coop, you might say, and actually he was married, but he ended up going back into China, and has it surfaced, at least from the time that Hong Kong was still under the control of the British, he never had come back out.
All right, so basically, of course, he was going to help the other agent escape, you know, if he needed to, and of course he didn't have that opportunity.
That's what the conjecture of the thing is. And one of the sad things, Dr. Stan, about this is, and I have certainly no sympathy at all for Larry Chen, but there was a disappointment when the fact that he committed suicide is that we never had the opportunity to really sit down with him and get the full details of everything he told him, and, you know, this, how his network operated and things like that.
All right. Well, Chris, you had a number of interesting experiences. One of them, and I thought was really so fascinating, was that there were a couple of people that you knew when you were in Florida, and they had connections with the highest-ranking people in Fidel Castro's Cuba.
Sure.
And they were taking trips into Cuba, contacting these people, and one of the key people, one of the close confidants of Fidel Castro, really wanted to hold a meeting with you. And, why don't you tell that story? Because I think what is really so revealing, I would think that the people in our government would do everything they could to possibly have as many contacts at the highest levels of Fidel Castro's government, and yet they consistently prevented the meeting that was planned. So you tell that story, because it's a fascinating insight, I believe, into our Cuban policy.
Well, this involved in and I used fictitious names because they are still alive and they still live in South Florida, but I used the names of Roberto and Fernando. And essentially these were two Cuban nationals who had come out of Cuba, but after Castro took over, but they had the ability to go back in there. And that was one of the great misnomers at the time, is that there was actually pretty frequent travel to, you had to go through a third country, but you could go in and out of Cuba. So these fellows, I had met them there when I was assigned to the Miami office and had an instant liking for them. And they told me one day that they were getting ready to go back into Cuba.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Mr. I.C. Smith, the former top G-man, and he's telling a story, one of the stories about when he was stationed, and he was, I believe he was the station chief there in Florida. Is that right?
I was the assistant special agent in charge at the time.
Okay, so assistant special agent in charge, and he knew a couple of Cubans, and he doesn't use the real names in the book because they're still alive, but they were going in and out of Cuba on a regular basis, and all this idea that, nobody's allowed to go into Cuba really wasn't true. You went to another country, then you go into Cuba, and they were going into Cuba, and will you pick up the story from there?
Yes, and before they left, I took just a plain piece of paper and had my secretary just kind of write a little note, you know, best wishes on your trip or something like that, and they gave it to them, and I had a real idea of what they were going to do with it, which in fact they did. They actually carried it into Havana, and they showed it to a remarkable fellow named Antonio de la Guardia. Now, Antonio de la Guardia was a colonel, and he was truly a part of Fidel Castro's palace guard. He had a great access to Castro. He had a very informal relationship with him. And when they came back out, they actually brought a box of cigars. I certainly didn't ask them how they got the cigars through customs, but they brought a box of cigars out for me from De La Guardia.
And I thought it was showed great restraint as you burned those cigars because they were illegal.
Well, yes, we had to report gifts, of course, and so I sent a teletype to FBI headquarters saying that I had received this box of cigars. I didn't know the value, but they were being burned. And I never heard anything back from it. And actually, I didn't smoke, so I was having to parcel them out. But at any rate, this started a long series of negotiations. And what I found out happening was this: De La Guardia, at the knowledge of his boss, which was the General Herman Barrios, who was the head of the Cuban Intelligence Service, and Barrios' boss was a fellow named Jose Abrantes, who was the Minister of Interior, and of Fidel himself, they knew about these contacts. And so there was this, started this negotiations of, and they wanted to have a meeting. And it was interesting about it that I said, well, why the FBI? And they said, well, they trust the FBI and they trust you, but they didn't trust the State Department, they didn't trust the CIA.
And I think that's really so important. I've heard that from many people from Cuba. They do not trust the CIA. They do not trust the American State Department. But at least the FBI, they felt, would be honest with them. And so that's why they were willing to negotiate with you. And this is not simply the communist leaders. This was actually the rank-and-file people who lived in Cuba who were anti-communist. They didn't trust the CIA either.
Sure. Well, they had good reason, because about this same time, and the Cubans have a terrific knack of doing this, is that they constantly have a way of, it seems like, embarrassing the United States. But in this particular case, they aired on Cuban television a whole series of 30-minute shows where they showed how they had compromised CIA operations inside of Cuba. They had them on videotape in color, and you could hear the birds chirping, and you could hear the CIA guys scratching around in the grass trying to look for, the information supposed to have been dropped for them. You could hear one of them is kind of amusing, hear his wife in the background, saying, would you hurry up, that sort of thing. And they totally had compromised the CIA operations inside of Cuba. So yeah. The mistrust that they had for the CIA there was probably well-founded on that basis alone. But this continued on, and finally, I was able to get agreement to have the meeting with Antonio de la Guardia in Madrid. Turned out in about 36 hours or so before the meeting was supposed to go is that I received a phone call and was told that the meeting, I couldn't attend the meeting. And so the meeting was never held. And what was interesting is, and I just show you how they were, is that when I asked my Fernando and Roberto, I said, listen, the next time you go back into Cuba, would you get General Barrios or somebody to send me a set of those videotapes that they did in shown on Cuban TV, but I don't speak Spanish, would you get them to make me some in English? Well, they were supposed to come back. They didn't show up, but the next day or so they did show up, and they're grinning from ear to ear, and they hand me this set of videotapes that they had dubbed in English for me.
And these were the ones that showed the CIA agents, they were constantly being monitored by intelligence.
Sure.
And so they not only have them in Spanish, they have them in English. They've given them to you as sort of a sign of goodwill. This is your tax money at work, ladies and gentlemen. Either the most incompetent people in the world or Well, maybe there's some other agenda there. We'll be back in just a moment with Mr. I.C. Smith, and we'll tell more about this incredible story. And, of course, the meeting was never held, but what did happen was that eventually all the people they were negotiating with in Cuba were eventually executed. We'll just conjecture as to why that might have been. They wanted to contact the Americans. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I guess this evening is Mr. I.C. Smith. His book, Inside, A Top G-Man Exposes Spies, Lies, and Bureaucratic Bungling Inside the FBI. Well, anyway, as far as the meeting that you were going to hold, the FBI canceled it within, about 36 hours of the time you were to get over to Madrid. And, of course, eventually you determined that the real reason that the LaGuardia wanted to contact you, you think he would like to have defected with the United States. Was that right?
That's correct. Fernando and Roberto came back after they were very disappointed because they were actually going to accompany De La Guardia to Madrid, and I was going to meet them there. And I asked them what happened when they had found out that the meeting had been canceled at this late date. And he said, well, says Barrios had just erupted. He had a volcanic temper anyway. And, this is the case of the Yankees trying to embarrass us again. And said Fidel was there. And says Fidel looked at him and he says, was this Mr. Smith lying to us? And one of them told him no, I think he probably got caught up in the politics. And says Fidel turned and he said, well, I think I can understand that, and turned and walked out of the room. But they were absolutely convinced, and I'm convinced, that De La Guardia was exploring. He's a very mercenary individual, Dr. Stan, and I think he was exploring an opportunity to defect. And if that was the case, that would have been an absolutely remarkable coup. It's even better than the defection of Air Force General Rafael Del Pena that happened while I was in Miami, and I detailed the story in the book. But this would have been a remarkable coup, probably far beyond anything that's ever come out of Cuba, in fact, in total. And, of course, later on, as De La Guardia was accused of drug running by Castro, and he was put before a firing squad.
So then, of course, you tell the story of this General Pino. He was the top Air Force general in Cuba. And so you were wanting to tell that story because it's really rather fascinating. I think that most people would love to get out of Cuba, but it's very, very difficult to do it. You're risking your life. If you try to escape, and specifically right today, if you try to escape from Cuba on a raft and you get within sight of the United States and the Coast Guard sees you first, they'll pick you up, take you back to Cuba, where you'll be thrown in jail. So we have some sort of a working arrangement with the communists, which is very, very hard to understand. Why did we send Elian Gonzalez back to Fidel, which only increased his prestige, not only in Cuba, throughout the world? Why would the Justice Department send a squad, 100 men or more, down there to seize Elian Gonzalez down in Miami? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I guess this evening Mr. I.C. Smith, and he is going to tell us a story about one of the top Air Force generals, or was he the top Air Force general who defected to the United States?
Yes, he was then and now is the highest-ranking Cuban defector that has ever come to the United States.
Well, how did that happen to come about, and of course, what part did you play in that?
Well, actually May the 27th of 1987, I received a phone call from one of the agents that worked for me down around Key West, and he says they had reports that a Cuban plane was in almost ready to touch down at a naval station there. A few minutes later, he called me back. He said, listen, he says, and this the fellow that just came in is an Air Force general by the name of Rafael Del Pena. I frankly didn't recognize the name, And by the way, this is kind of an indication that sometimes I'm somewhat perplexed by this whole business of the lack of communication between the FBI and the CIA, because that was not my experience at all.
No, well, that's, Chris, what we're told today. That sort of explains what happened in 9-1-1, because after all, the FBI couldn't speak to the CIA and the CIA couldn't speak to the FBI. That's what we're told, but is that really true?
Oh no, no. I mean, this certainly wasn't my experience. I don't think it was an institutional problem. It may have been some individual problems, but it certainly wasn't institutional. Because, like in this case, the first person I called was my CIA counterpart in the Miami area, and he got right back to me and said, "Hey, this is a big one." I never even forget him telling me that. And essentially, what we had here is that General Del Pena, who was he was a hero of the Bay of Pigs. He actually shot a plane down of the Bay of Pigs, from their standpoint, what they call the invaders. I think it was Brigade 2506 that was going in there, and he became very much a hero of the revolution. But it was one of the interesting things about Del Pena is that he never was really, I don't think, a communist. He viewed himself as kind of a patriot and what have you. And in fact, when he was a kid growing up, his father had gotten concerned about some of the people he was hanging around, including Fidel Castro. And he actually sent him to a Baptist school in Tennessee where he went to school for a while.
So he was basically a Christian then?
Yes. And but he did get involved in the revolution. But he just simply wanted to be a flyer. He wanted to, he viewed it as just being a patriot and something like this. Well, as over the years went by, of course, he became more and more disenchanted with Castro and communism. So one day he just decided, I've had enough. Of course, he had been in Angola with the Cubans there, and he was very close to General Ochoa, who had been put before a firing squad, with De La Guardia. But, so he just got his wife. He had a son that was a jet pilot in the Cuban Air Force. He had a teenage son and had a little small daughter. And he just, because he could get a small plane, and he went and got a small plane and just told the people, said, "Hey, we're just going to be flying around a little bit." And so he went out to sea, and then he ducked down real close to the water. And I'm talking about a matter of just a few feet, because he had to evade the radar. Well, of course, the American radar picked him up as he got closer, and his family, and this tells you something about Cuba. He was afraid to even tell his family what he was doing until he landed.
I think that really tells you a lot about, you know, the fear that people live in. He was afraid to tell his wife, his kids, anybody, that he was going to try to defect for fear that they would tell somebody else, and of course he would be executed. And this is what it really is like in a communist country. In fact, the general you were just talking about who was executed along with De La Guardia, he was a very popular general, and he wasn't accused because he wasn't loyal to Fidel, was he? Wasn't it because he was so popular after the campaign and over there in Angola that Fidel really was fearful of him as a competitor?
Oh, I think so. And it's one of the interesting, the last letter I got from Del Pena, and it was kind of interesting, and his last words in that letter before, you know, sincerely yours, he says, "God bless you and your family." And I thought about that a lot, and I said, well, you know, this is certainly not the what you would expect from a communist revolutionary. This was a man who I think was just thought he was tried to be a patriot for his own country, and he finally just got to the point that he just couldn't stand it anymore, and he came out. But it's extraordinary, you know. He's a fascinating man, and the book details some of the things he told me about. Photographing Homestead Air Force Base and going into Vietnam and all the equipment that we left behind there, and how he got in an F-5 airplane, never been in one before, and just flew it around, and it's a great story.
And this is the Air Force general that who defected?
Yes, sir. That was General Del Pena. He even told me the paranoia. One of the little interesting stories he told me was that, and I guess if you're the president of Cuba, you can do this, that Fidel would go duck hunting, but of course he didn't want to wait till the ducks fly, so they would fly planes over and make the ducks fly that way, and then he'd shoot them. See? So I guess rank does have its privileges.
It certainly does. Well, of course, there were so many fascinating things that you had. One of the things that, about your book is I feel that you were very candid about some of your criticism about what happened at Waco. And you tell the story. You weren't at Waco, but you were back in Washington, D.C. Why don't you tell that story of what happened that morning as, of course, the building full of women and children was going up in flames?
Yes, I had a friend of mine, a fellow I worked with. He stuck his head in the door and he says, "Turn on your TV." Well, I kept my TV. In those days, the only cable network you had was CNN. And so I flipped it on, and it first picture that I saw was that building, and the flag was at right angles with a post, which gave an indication of how hard the wind was blowing. I mean, I could tell that the wind was blowing 20 or 30 knots, and the smoke was billowing out. I said, my goodness, what are they doing?
And they were putting in tear gas at the time, and your point was, why are you putting in tear gas when the wind's blowing that?
That's absolutely the case. You talk to any law enforcement officer, and that's one of the things, that when you insert tear gas, you got to make sure that the wind is kind of still and what have you, and everything. And we're sitting there watching this, and I'm just almost speechless. The fact that they got that tank punching holes in there and all this sort of thing. And then one of my colleagues said, well, they'll start coming out. I said, no, they aren't going to come out because they aren't really hostages. And you remember, Dr. Stan, that any time a hostage taker takes hostages, the hostages themselves become a point of stress for the hostage taker. But these people weren't. They were actually providing support to him.
To Koresh, David Koresh, right?
That's right. And Koresh was sitting in there, and he had all these people that were actually supporting him. They weren't a point of stress at all. And I never had any expectation that any number at all, certainly, and I that would go running out of there. And then, of course, that evening, I went down into the basement to get in my car, and I saw one of the fellows that had been involved with the planning of this thing and everything, and I told him, Mike, is this going to be a problem? He said, no, it's not going to be a problem for us because we didn't set the fire or anything like that. And I just erupted. I can remember still doing it, and said, my God, Mike, I said, you got women and children that have burned up. How can you say this is not going to be a problem? And I was just flabbergasted that they didn't recognize the what had happened, and this is something that's going to follow the FBI for a generation.
Yes, it will for a good long time. Now, of course, write here about your experience with Kenneth Starr. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When I went to Little Rock, and in July of 1995, and Ken Starr had just taken over as the independent counsel from Robert Fisk, and actually Ken came to see me that very same day, still unpacking boxes and stuff like that, and I had a instant liking for Ken, and had a old Southern charm about him in a lot of ways and stuff like that, very polite and what have you. But as time went on, and I saw him virtually every time he came to Little Rock, he would make a point of visiting with me and what have you. And frankly, I became something of his kind of a sounding board for him to how he was being viewed in Arkansas, because I traveled extensively and I gave over 100 speeches my 3 years there and that sort of thing. And I had a pretty good network that I was starting to develop there myself. But increasingly, Dr. Stan, I became concerned that Ken was probably not the right person for the job as it was being developed, because this was not just your typical little white collar crime case. This became nothing more but a bare knuckle backroom brawl. And of course, what actually happened was, particularly with James Carville and Paul Begala, they began to attack Starr personally, and which had never been done before in the annals of this sort of thing. And he didn't really fight back as I thought he probably should. And then, of course, after the convictions of Jim and Susan McDougal and Jim Guy Tucker, they tried a couple of good old boys from Perry County, Branscombe and Hill, and they had a hung jury. Well, the jury, as I found later, they had actually voted 11-1 and 10-2 for conviction. According to which count, there was a number of counts. They were 11-1 for conviction, and some another count or two, they were 10-2. But they decided not to retry them, and it went downhill from there. And they never really recovered. And so they went 2 years without, as I told Ken, I said, you got to put a pelt on the wall. But they lost the PR game at about this point, 2 years later.
Well, I never understood why Kenneth Starr didn't get Jim McDougal out of prison, because he was ready to testify against the president. And, of course, there's a lot of question in a lot of people's mind as to The fact he was put in solitary, his medicines were taken away from him. And many people think he was killed there so he would testify against the president. I'm not saying that's true, but why didn't Kenneth Starve do the logical thing, get him out of prison and put him into protective custody someplace so he couldn't end up like the 50 other people that had made enemies of the president?
I never got a satisfactory answer. I raised that same thing. If it, why in the world is he? First of all, he's a sick man.
Sure.
They could have justified it. I never received a satisfactory response to that thing. And of course, at this same time, Susan McDougal was, she had been convicted of a felony. And then she had been served a subpoena to talk about, the next phase of the case, and she basically refused to do so. She wouldn't even give her name or anything. And she was being held in contempt. Well, by this time, she was never going to roll over and talk. And so my advice was, go ahead and convict her for the contempt and then move on. But they didn't do it. And, of course, during that next 2 years, and how many times did we hear 4 years, $40 million, over and over and over again? And after a while, that set in, and by this time, Ken had lost the PR battle. And, of course, and it's interesting, when she was finally tried, it was a hung jury. And, a hung jury is a victory only for the guilty. And then they didn't retry her again. Mark Garagos was the attorney, of course, and he was crowing about how she'd been found. She wasn't found not guilty. It was a hung jury.
Now somebody's putting up a lot of money for this whole thing on the other side, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get Mark Garagos as your attorney for Susan McDougal unless somebody's putting up big bucks. And I will say one thing for Bill Clinton. He always took good care of his friends.
Well, in this case, he took care of her because he gave her a pardon on his last day in office.
Right. Well, there are lots of things. Do you want to take a call? We've got Tim calling from Indianapolis. Now, Tim, remember that Mr. Smith wasn't involved with Waco at all. In his book simply covers just his impression in FBI headquarters that some people seem to take a sort of a callous indifference to what happened in Waco. Did you have a specific question along that line?
Oh, yes. Have you ever heard of a book called Circle of Death by Richmond Odom?
Yes, uh-huh. But,
have you?
But what was your question for Mr. Smith?
Well, regarding Waco, I mean, April 19th coming up here, it'll only be 12 years past. And I understand that Texas Rangers, Delta Force, and FBI agent sharpshooters were firing at the Americans that were trying to escape from the burning building.
Well, that may very well be true, but I don't think Mr. Smith's in a position to talk about that. We do have a couple of great four-tape sets. In fact, if you have not yet seen that video that Mike McDelton put out, that cost him his whole career on Waco. You really need to get that because there's some very serious questions. But I don't want to get into that when we have a guest talking specifically about the FBI.
Well, this is about Arkansas.
Okay, what about Arkansas?
Well, have you ever heard of a man by the name of Seth Ward?
Oh, yes. This is Webb Hubbell's father-in-law.
Do you know what type of business he had there in Arkansas?
Well, one of them was he had a business that had something to do with the parking meters.
Right, and didn't they ship in semi-automatic weapons and turn them into automatic weapons and ship them down to the Contras?
I never heard that part.
Well, that's according in a book called...
We don't want to really get off into a lot of other things. Go ahead.
Well, the pith of my argument is Bill Clinton is still, marching around. And he should have been arrested years ago.
Okay, but we don't want. That's not Mr. Smith's expertise. He's just talking about his book. But thanks so much for calling,
Tim.
Okay, and I think I know Tim feels very, very deeply about these things, but it's a little off Mr. Smith's subject of expertise here. But really, a fascinating look into the bad. Into a career, a proud career. Conclude the book talking about the sad state of affairs. What really were you referring to there?
Well, one of the great concerns that I have, and there's a couple of them, there's several of them that I kind of summed the book up with. I talk about the FBI deals with media, for example, and what have you. But there's two themes that I think that are, in many respects, are most important. One of course, is the fact that this whole politicization of the criminal justice system. One of the things, of course, that the Clintons did, they immediately fired all the United States attorneys, and you know, they wanted to get their people in there type thing. Well, this took months, and it kind of hamstrung the criminal justice system there for a while. And, of course, the people that they were putting in were not being selected on the basis of any expertise or criminal investigations or anything like that. They were being selected mainly for either gender or just loyalty type of issues. And so we ended up, and it was kind of interesting because I was at a meeting one time with a bunch of FBI executives. We were all there, and we kind of informally decided that the United States attorneys as a whole, based on those appointed by the Clintons, was the weakest bunch that we'd ever had in our, you know, and by this time we all had over 20 years in. So they were, you know, a pretty inept group overall as hell. The other thing, but this whole politicization, you know, the FBI has to have some sort of political independence in order to conduct those very sensitive political corruption type investigations. And if there again, it kind of crosses party lines on this thing. But the other thing that I have great concern about, with Dr. Stan, is the fact that all of the mistakes that were made in the FBI in the 9/11, and I'm pretty harsh on the FBI, and I talk about this, is the fact that there has never really been any accountability within the FBI for those people who were on duty when the mistakes were made. They were the managers, the senior managers who had created the bureaucracy and the atmosphere that caused the failure.
Hold that thought for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, our guest is Mr. I.C. Smith. He's saying that one of the problems with the FBI is nobody's ever held accountable, you know, and let's say you were responsible for, you know, intercepting or knowing about the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. But nobody's ever held responsible for anything. Nobody's really held responsible for what happened in Waco. Nobody's really held responsible for what happened at the Oklahoma City bombing. Nobody's held responsible for the murder of Randy Weaver's wife because his charges were trumped up by the BATF to try to force him to become an informant, and when he wouldn't go along with it, they set him up to go to court, but they gave him the wrong date, and everything was done. And when the jury heard this, they exonerated Randy Weaver. But nobody is responsible for the murder of people by the FBI snipers. So what's the solution?
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about, Dr. Stan, is that real change, when true reform, you know, this is not the result of a single event. This is it's a process, and it's going to take some time and patience, and it's going to take a commitment to a course of action that you know, that we can make sure that this is going to happen. And you know, the creation of a new department, that's a political thing, and it's, you know, one of the great problems that you see right now with Homeland Security is it frankly is just not working.
Right.
And it's going to be a long time if it ever worked. But it goes back to this whole business there, this unwillingness to fix responsibility. And one of the things I talk about is that, you know, there's a fundamental part of command, and that means command, you both have rewards as well as its perils, and the failure to adhere to that fundamental tenet almost surely it's going to happen is that sometime in the future that, you know, terrorists are going to strike again. Of course, fingers will point and politicians will posture, and of course we will revisit the same process again,
and Americans will die and nobody will be held responsible.
That's right. You know, that's the historical consequences of failing to come to grips with mistakes after they occur. You know, with this whole 9/11 commission, I can remember back in probably about 1993 or 94, they had something called the Aspin Commission. It was after Les Aspin, after he'd been fired as the Department of Defense, you know. And we did the same thing. This was there again to look at the roles and capabilities of the U.S. intelligence community. But you ended up, for the most part, they were political types, and you ended up with a political document, and that's kind of what you have with the 9/11 thing.
And, of course, what you do is you placate the American people, you give them the impression that something's being done, whereas in reality it's simply a distraction, so that then nobody's going to ask who was responsible and who is going to have to be fired. Hey, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Roger's been patiently hanging on here. Roger, do you have a quick question?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping to bounce it off your guest, but what he described, it suggests or buttresses my thinking that with Ken Starr, it's like the fix is in because, you know, he seems to go along with full energy, and then at the critical juncture, like what he did with Bill Clinton, he says, oh, there's more than enough evidence of perjury, et cetera, to bring charges, but will drop it because he's guessing that a jury won't find him guilty.
Well, of course, that wasn't what really happened. What was that they actually indicted him, the House of Representatives indicted him. They took the charges over to the Senate, and because of the Masonic connections, certainly Senator Arlen Specter and the Speaker of the Senate, why, of course, at least the Chairman of the Senate, the Majority Leader of the Senate,
at that time,
there was no way that they were going to go after somebody with strong Masonic connections. Hey, we're out of time, Roger. Thanks so much. And this is the time when we have, of course, to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that if you're out there in the listening audience listening to us, many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And so, if you would be interested, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. That's how we're able to do what we do. 5 hours every day on the radio, 5 hours every day on the internet, 5 hours every day on satellite, 4 hours every day on shortwave. Your job is to help us. Your job is to tell other people what you learn here at Radio Liberty. Your job is, of course, to encourage other people to listen and become educated. There's so much more to the story of Fidel Castro. We're putting together a new video on that. Probably most people don't know that when Fidel Castro came to the United States, he visited the boss. He visited David Rockefeller and was with him one day and then had a private meeting with him another day. Why would the head of a communist nation visit with the head of the capitalist nation? Because really, whether the Democrats or Republicans are in office, David Rockefeller's and his connections have always controlled both political parties. And I would like to suggest that most of the what we believe about this conflict between communism and capitalism has created the finest enemy money could buy. And if you want to get in the background of that, you'll want to see our new video. It's coming out on Fidel Castro, not available, but will be in a few weeks. And then, of course, you want to see my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. We still have copies of his book, although when those are gone, that'll be the end of it. And then, of course, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and you get the book or the video or the book and the video and the audio tape. We have so many other videos. We have a great new video called None Dare Call It Genocide. None Dare Call It Genocide goes into the background of so many of the things that are going on today that the average person doesn't understand. But why is cancer on the rise? Why has cancer replaced heart disease as the number one killer in America? Why is the average age of life in Africa and even here in the United States beginning to diminish? Certainly in Africa, why the average lifespan has dropped from about 65 to 35 in many of the countries. In Russia, it's dropped from about 65 to 58. Here in the United States, it seems to be leveling off. Is there something else going on? And I would like to suggest there is. There is a plan. And we outline it in the video, None Dare Call It Genocide. We give you the writings of the people on the other side where you can learn and understand what it's about. If you haven't yet gotten a copy of our Sustainable Development Syllabus, it contains my Population Control Agenda monograph. You need to. That's the Sustainable Development Syllabus. You need the video, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. You need Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, and you need to pray for America. You need to pray for revival. You need to pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are really at war today. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us from Maryland on the East Coast, and where it's past the witching hour back there, we have with us Joan Pion. Hi, Joan. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Well, Joan, of course, has been to a number of the international conferences where the captains and the kings and the rulers of this world meet to plan our future. In fact, she's just back from the recent World Economic Summit meeting in Davos. So I'm going to let her tell you a little bit about the meeting she's attended, what she has learned. But you must understand, ladies and gentlemen, there is an elite that rules the world. They tie into international banking, international corporations. They tie into various socialist organizations, the great tax-exempt foundations. But, of course, they are people of great wealth who believe that they have the right to rule the common folks. And they determine the course of the economics. They determine the course of the governments. They determine the course of the nations of the world. So with that as a background, Joan Vion.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. It's my pleasure to report on the World Economic Forum. This is my 7th World Economic Forum. It is my 65th global meeting, covering conferences almost around the world, every continent but Asia, in an attempt to understand truth. And in looking to understand truth, it also encompasses how you and I are to live, how we are to pray, and how we are to operate in a world that is controlled by people with far more greater resources than you and I, and far more greater power than you and I. Unfortunately, at one time I had this naive understanding that when America got its constitution, that we truly became free and we were no longer feudalistic. Well, unfortunately, for you and I, that's no longer true. We live in a very feudalistic society, and that is as a result of the international level that has been put in place since, it's been coming for at least over 100 years, but the bottom line is since 1944 with the establishment of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The United Nations followed in 1945 with the World Trade in 1994. And then the International Criminal Court in 1998, and the new terrorist war as a result of the attack on America in 2001. So what does that have to do with the World Economic Forum? For those of you who are not familiar with the World Economic Forum, let me explain just who attends these high-level meetings and what they do. And I guess we'll get that on the other side of the hour.
Well, we will. Let me just point out that at one time, America was an entirely different world. What people have not realized is that ever since the very inception of America, shortly after the Pilgrims arrived, or perhaps even with the Pilgrims, came a group of people that were Rosicrucians. They came from the dark side. They were sent by Francis Bacon to come to America to take this country over so that we could become the New Atlantis. And Bacon had written a book by that title, The New Atlantis. We were to lead the world into the New World Order, the New World Religion. After 1944, 1945, the things that Joan has described came to pass, and America then changed, and changed forever. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joan Vian, and we're talking about the meetings that Joan goes to where these men, and many of them associated with the dark side, many of them associated with secret societies, and of course some of them are quite naive, not really understanding the spiritual dimension of what's going on today, but they meet to plan your future and mine. People of great wealth, people of great power, people who see nothing wrong with using wars, assassination, revolutions, epidemics, call it what you will, to manipulate the common folks, because they believe in a ruling aristocracy. They believe that there are certain people who are born to rule, and most people are incapable of looking after their own affairs. In fact, that's what David Rockefeller told a good friend of mine. Some men are born to rule, but most people are born to be ruled, So these people meet, and when they meet, Joan Vian is there. Go ahead, Joan.
Well, not at all of them, but as many as I can, I'm able to go to. The people who go to the World Economic Forum, and in my opinion, I consider it possibly as powerful, if not more powerful, than the Bilderbergers, because at the World Economic Forum, 1,000 CEOs from various corporations in the world attend on a yearly basis. Now, the names and the countries that these CEOs come from changes as well. It depends on the objective of the conference. So there's like a rotating database, if you will, of 1,000 CEOs. This year, the market capitalization was $8 trillion. Along with the CEOs, or business, then comes governmental, both on the international level, representing all levels of the United Nations, whether it's the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, the World Health, etc. And then you have the presidents and prime ministers of various countries, and in many cases even the sheikhs. And then besides different world leaders, again rotating depending on what's happening on a yearly basis, you will also have, let me throw in royalty, and different years, different royal families come, whether it's the royal family of Sweden or perhaps the Habsburgs or different countries, whether it's Jordan or this year the Prince of Holland was there, the Prince of Belgium was there, Prince Albert from Monaco was there. So there's a lot of different members of royalty that come, as well as then in the last 2 years they have invited 40 to 50 members of non-governmental organizations, as well as 20 to 30 members of different religions.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joan is describing who's attend the meetings of the World Economic Forum in Davos. There certainly are the financial leaders of the world. There are the royalty, and there were a number of members of the royalty at this meeting. There were the members of the NGOs. And then, of course, there were these people tied into international finance who really determined the fate of nations. So this is where the captains and the kings meet together to plan the destiny of the world. Pick up the story from there, Joan.
Many of these people, I have found, they give us a nice little booklet of that has about 1,500 people in it. It gives their face, their picture, their biography, what they do, those kinds of things. And yearly I go through it, and it's very interesting because for a couple of the 7 years that I attended, there was a core representative of people who were there that were members of the Council for Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, only one or two Bilderbergers, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum, and the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. Another year that I looked to see who was who, I decided to find out where they were educated. And I found a direct correlation between people who were members of those organizations and people who were schooled at most of the Ivy League schools, such as Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Oxford, etc. Lastly, let me just say that there are people, again, it all rotates depending on what's happening. I've seen David Rockefeller there, Lord Rothschild 1 year, Yasser Arafat, Secretary General Kofi Annan's been there different years, Javier Solana, Hillary Clinton was there the first year I went. She gave a flawless one-hour speech without notes, and Newt Gingrich, not to be outdone, did the same thing. And then the following year, in 2000, Bill Clinton was there when he was president, and he joked about how there wasn't anybody home because the whole cabinet was in Davos. So it's very interesting, but the bottom line is there's tremendous power. And with tremendous power goes a tremendous agenda. What I found the first year that I went there in 1998 is that it basically is a mini United Nations conference. The CEOs and the people who attend are really given a crash course in the goals and objectives of the United Nations or world government.
And I think that really our listeners need to understand the real goal of everything going on is a world government under a ruling elite. The destruction of national sovereignty, the destruction of individual freedom, and of course this mass accumulation of wealth in the hands of an unelected group of rulers. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, but I find it fascinating, Dr. Stand, as I've gone there year after year, is that the main thrust that the World Economic Forum puts forth is the fact that they are there to help companies network around the world. And so there are many people who go there for the networking purposes, but as you know from your study of secret societies, that there's that inner core of people who know exactly what's happening, and they are the ones who are driving the whole agenda. The World Economic Forum is a non-governmental organization, and they have consultative status at ECOSOC at the United Nations. And so, therefore, it is a branch, an arm of the United Nations with the sole purpose to increase the whole agenda of the United Nations. From the standpoint of my research, having covered 65 global meetings over the last 10 years, I have studied in depth, and I think I can take the credit for helping people understand in the very early days sustainable development, the family dependency ratio, public-private partnership, the global economic effects of all these things, and a few other areas. And I would have to say that in all my 10 years of covering global meetings, this meeting was a complete apex of everything that I have studied in the last 10 years. It was quite a monumental meeting, and let me explain why. One of the first, well, I went to my first global meeting in 1994. I thought I was sophisticated. I thought I understood American politics and world politics, only to find out I knew nothing, because when I went to Cairo, I realized that there was an international level above the nation state that I knew nothing of. While I knew the name United Nations or the World Bank or the IMF, I didn't know anything else, and I had no idea as to how those structures had evolved in strength, in power, and in number, as well as agenda since when they were founded in the 1940s. So when I went to Cairo, I had quite a wake-up call as I saw world government. That's the only phrase I can give it. That's the only way I can label it and identify it, is I saw this world governmental structure in operation. I came home from that meeting pretty upset with a suitcase full of material, determined to find out how big, vast, deep, and broad the agenda was. In going through that material, I saw in one piece of information only that the United Nations was going to float the idea of global taxation at a follow-up meeting to be held 6 months from Cairo in 1995, February, in Copenhagen. And I determined then to go. The bottom line is you don't have global tax unless there's global government. Throughout the 10 years of monitoring and following and tracking and researching global taxation, it went from just an idea or a concept in Copenhagen in 1995 to an idea that is no longer an idea, but it is now on the table. President Bush. It's been on the table at the United Nations since 2000 and 2002, and then 2002. When did I go to South Africa? I guess that was 2002. I can't remember anymore.
It was in 2002.
Yeah. So,
that was, of course, that was the fourth Earth Summit meeting that was held in Johannesburg.
That's correct. And so that that particular meeting, the global tax idea was raised, and it was in the program of action, but there wasn't a whole lot said verbally. However, French President Jacques Chirac put it on the table at the Group of Eight meeting that was held in June in Sea Island, Georgia, here in the United States. And at that time, I talked to somebody from the French delegation because Jacques Chirac was determined to have new ideas for global taxation other than the core five or six that had been floating around for the last 5 years, 10 years. In Davos, French President Jacques Chirac opened up the meeting the first evening by calling for global taxation. And interestingly enough, all of the different forms of global taxation that he called for have basically been around for about 15 years. While some of them haven't been the most popular, they've been, you know, reinvented, reinfigured, reconfigured, whatever you want to call it, for what they now want to do.
I think it's important that people understand that this idea of world government goes back to Nimrod. Certainly he wanted to rule the world, the pharaohs wanted to rule the world, the Assyrians wanted to rule the world, Alexander the Great wanted to rule the world, Rome and Greece wanted to rule the world, Napoleon wanted to rule the world, Hitler wanted to rule the world, but the person who's come closest to it than anybody is Cecil John Rhodes. And through the Rhodes Scholarships and the secret societies he created, which are manifest today as the Council on Foreign Relations of the United States and the Royal Institute of International Affairs in Great Britain and throughout the Commonwealth, these are the very nidus of this move towards world government. But if you've got to have world government, you have to have an army. Where is the money going to come from? If you have to depend upon the countries, that's not dependable enough. People could cut off your money. You want to have a court. You want to have a police force. You want to have a parliament. You want to have a massive bureaucracy to control the people. But how are you going to enforce it without money? And that's what the world tax is really all about. And, of course, the Law of the Sea Treaty, which the current administration is so intent upon getting through, and I'm talking about George W. Bush, once you get that through, that will give simply another means of massive transfer of funds to the international body, because they will control all the wealth on the seabed floor, and they can actually eventually begin to tax people for using their oceans. That's what the Law of the Sea Treaty is about. And this has been planned going back to April of 1974 in Foreign Affairs magazine, when Richard Gardner talked about how to bring about this world government, they would have to do an end run around the Constitution. Richard Gardner, Rhodes Scholar, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, appointed as ambassador to Spain by Bill Clinton, part of the elite group that ruled the world. They swear to uphold the Constitution. They hate America. Their goal is this world government, and whether they know it or not, that, of course, is to be the government of the coming Antichrist. So pick up the story, Joan.
I love you, Dr. Stan. Pick up the story, yes. I would say that I wrote an article after attending the G8 meeting in Sea Island, in which I was told by a member of the Bush administration that the Law of the Sea is already a done deal, that when they go to pass it, they've already implemented 95% of it.
And so they can't tell the American people that their loyalty is not to America. Why we would be upset. And so little by little they will steal our freedom and our wealth and impoverish the American people as we move from freedom towards fascism under the new ruling elite, the kingdoms, captains of the kings that rule the world, that attend the meetings that Joan attends. And of course here your future and your children's future is being decided. And you know the most amazing thing is why Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly never tell us what's going on. My guest is Joan Vian, and just commenting that she's been told that the Law of the Sea Treaty, it's called abbreviated LOST, L-O-S-T, Law of the Sea Treaty. It's all a done deal. The Bush administration is going to go along with it, betraying once again our national sovereignty. But while our attention is focused on what's going on in Iraq and the weeping widows and wives, why we're losing our freedom here at home. That's how you advance the agenda. You have wars to distract the people, and you know a better way to distract people from what's going on at home than a war in Vietnam or in Korea or in Iraq? Go ahead, Joan.
You know, it's very, very sad. I would like to just make mention that most people think in the Garden of Eden that the first sin was the fact that Eve ate the fruit, or the apple, whatever. The bottom line is the first sin was not Eve eating the apple. It was the lies, the deceit, the deception, the distortion that Satan planted in her mind in order to lead her astray from the real goal and objective that she already knew, which was truth. And so, through these wars, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it is heartbreaking to read the stories of those young men with families who have been killed in Iraq. And that, as you say, is nothing but a cover for the elimination of our sovereignty at every turn. And when we start looking at this global tax that Jacques Chirac suggested at the World Economic Forum, I would say that if you think we are in bondage now, and I could go through from an economic standpoint and paint the current economic picture, and while it looks very, very good, the bottom line is America is deeply, deeply in debt, and this global tax will only put us in a position. The only way that I can describe it is that we will be forced, like the Israelites, to make bricks without straw. The global tax that Chirac recommended, there were a number of them. I'm not going to go through them because I believe that what they are looking to do is throw something out to the public that is so ridiculous or so sophisticated as an international tax that the real item that they want, people will go, oh, phew, all right, fine, we already have it, no problem. When Jacques Chirac put global taxation on the table, former President Clinton said the world's never had a global tax. You know, I'm not sure this is going to work. There were other people who said it'll take too long, it's too sophisticated, we don't have 5 years, we need the money now. And so, in order to get the money now, let me explain how they're going about doing this. In 1970, 69 or 70, I believe it came through the United Nations as a way to help poor starving countries, because even back then, the United Nations was talking about poor starving countries and how to help them.
And now they're poor and more starving than they were back in those days.
Absolutely.
And the more we do to help them, why, the worse gets yet for the people in the third world countries. Go ahead, John.
Anyway, I believe it was the United Nations that came up with something called the Overseas Development Assistance, ODA. Most of the rich countries of the world, which would be the G7 countries, the United States, Canada, Germany, Japan, Italy, France, and Great Britain, have already put in place this kind of development assistance to countries, ODA. Is that a break?
This is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Joan Vian, and she's just talking about how they're putting together the plans for this global tax as quickly as possible. Pick up the story, Joan.
And so with the overseas development assistance already in place here in the United States, it'll be a slam dunk for them to just raise it. Currently, the United States, as well as many of the other group of G7 countries, Russia is going to get some, they're not going to give it. Currently, the G7 countries give about 0.2% of gross national product. For the United States, that's about $16 billion a year. And this money goes for various forms of aid. It goes for natural disaster. It goes to help the poor, the starving, who knows, probably the rich and the richer as well. And the Overseas Development Assistance, there is a great deal of discussion and has been going back to some of the meetings that I mentioned in 2000, the Millennium Summit, and 2002, there was the Financing for Development meeting in there were two meetings that year. The Financing for Development meeting in Monterey, where they talked about how to find money for the poor, and the Overseas Development Assistance was recommended there that America and all the other countries increase their aid from 0.2 to 0.7. Now, that's really what was hammered on at the World Economic Forum. The fact that all these countries, the rich countries, have to increase the ODA from 0.2 to 0.7. France, Germany, and England made commitments in Davos to raise their overseas development assistance to 0.7 over the next 5 years. So now it's like the onus is on the United States as well as the other countries. And in raising our overseas development assistance, it has been calculated, according to Dr. Jeffrey Sachs of the Earth Institute, that it would require another $55 billion of American taxpayers' dollars. Now, $55 billion is a heck of a lot of money. So we now have a permanent transfer of wealth here. You know, a little bit is one thing, a lot is another thing.
Well, you know, of course, it's been said that foreign aid is a process by which you take money from poor people in a rich country to give to rich people in a poor country. And this is basically what it is. If we were really helping the people, wouldn't they be better off than they were 20 years ago? If you haven't read this wonderful new book we're carrying called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, written by a man who is part and parcel of the devious plan to basically get the nations of the world into debt to the United States so that they could never pay off their debt, and all the interest on their to service their debt would come to the great corporations and the IMF and the World Bank. And certainly he points out that what they do is they go in and they bribe the people who are the leaders of the countries so that they will take on the debt, and the money doesn't get to the people, and more people die every year of starvation as a direct result of our benevolence in giving money to the poor countries.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. When I first understood public-private partnership, Bill Clinton was president, and I was giving a speech somewhere, and I projected that possibly when Bill Clinton got out of office, he would set up the William J. Clinton Foundation, and he would participate in public-private partnerships, which is a wonderful, new, marvelous way of skimming off the top in third-world countries.
And in fact, he's really recently been appointed to head tsunami relief for the United States. Isn't that nice to know that this great paragon of virtue is so dedicated to helping the poor people?
Well, not only that, but you see, he did set up the William Jefferson Clinton Foundation, and he gave a speech last year, and he reiterated it this year, that this man, who did everything he could to increase abortion and condom distribution here in the United States, is now concerned that not one child die before they have to in third world countries. And so he's now partnering with a number of countries to help protect these kids in one way or the other through AIDVAX, through vaccinations and other things.
William Jefferson Clinton gives hypocrisy a bad name. When he was the president, we have still have the article out of the New York Times, he and the Rwanda genocide was going on. He ordered everybody in the cabinet not to use the word genocide because he commented, if we use the word genocide, why we would have to intervene. And then after 800,000 Christians had been hacked to death with machetes, why Bill Clinton, with tears in his eyes, said, oh, we're so sorry, if we'd known what was going on, why we would have done something to solve. I just want to apologize for not helping. As I say, he gives hypocrisy a bad name. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've got Joan Vion here, back from the World Economic Summit in Davos, Switzerland, and bring us up to date on what's really going on with the captains and the kings who rule the world, their plan for global taxation, their plan... Well, go ahead, Joan.
Before I do, I would just like to give out my phone number if people are interested in what we do.
Why don't we wait until we get back? Because right now we don't have all of our stations on.
Oh, all right.
As soon as we get back, why you get your telephone number out. And thank you for mentioning that. We'll so proceed, and I'll give you the clue when we have everybody back together.
All right, as a deal. With regard to the World Economic Forum, let me just say that after attending for 7 years and watching and listening to the rhetoric and how these CEOs have really been led down a primrose path that leads to destruction, although many of them have good hearts, and I heard testimonies from a number of them, and I believe it comes truly from their heart, but they have absolutely no idea of the fire they are playing with. And they have bit off hook, line, and sinker the whole agenda of world government. Do they recognize it as being world government? That's a good question, because you see, they operate on the transnational level to begin with. So anything that facilitates their ability to do business globally, you know, is all right with them. And I don't think they would even recognize it as being a breach of sovereignty for the country that they live in. But needless to say, the bottom line is, many of these companies are now partnering with the World Health Organization, the International Red Cross, the World Health Organization, well, that's not the one I want to say, UNICEF, the World Food Program, the World Food Organization. Right? So they're now partnering, all these corporations are now lining up to partner with these international organizations to help them get food or aid or whatever the case may be to wherever it needs to go. And I heard testimonies from some of these men, and they feel absolutely wonderful that they have done something and their employees are happy and they are proud. But the bottom line is, as I wrote in my book, United Nations Global Straitjacket, that the early church was birthed into the world government. Jesus Christ was birthed into the world government. They recognized it. They worked around it and through it without becoming part of it. And I would say that even today, as we talk about these people, that there are many Christians that have no idea, don't care to understand world government and what's happening on the international level, and yet they are at risk.
Hold that thought for
becoming
just a moment
part
here.
Of it.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Joan Vion, and now, Joan, is the time to get out your telephone number, to get out your website, to let people know about the various newsletters you put out, and ask them to give serious consideration to getting those newsletters. You can't put the price out, but you can tell people about the newsletters and how to get hold of them.
Well, for people who are interested, as I was mentioning earlier, this is a ministry. I basically sacrifice to go to these meetings, things that I could be doing that would enhance my own bottom line. But I am a gravely concerned citizen. I write two newsletters. One is an economic newsletter. It comes out quarterly. It talks about the global changes and how it affects our ability to save, but most of all, where we need to save or how we need to invest. And then I write a geopolitical newsletter that comes out bi-monthly, and it talks and explains and gives in-depth research about these conferences and what it means and what the agenda is. So there are two newsletters. I have a number of videos and other things that are available. For people who are interested, they can call 301-371-0541, 301-371-0541. And while we're at it, I really am in need of 150,000 frequent flyer miles this year to go to a number of other meetings that are on my agenda to cover, because they are all part and parcel of this continuing evolution towards world government. So if people have 50,000 or 60,000 that they can help me with for an international ticket, I would really very much appreciate it, and they can call 301-371-0541.
Okay, fine. And, of course, Joan's letters, I would say, are outstanding. I always look forward to them, especially the ones she did recently on Are We Going to Relive the 70s? And that really has been reprinted by a number of ministries. It goes into the background of what happened in the 70s, what's going on now. And if you don't understand the economic cycles, you don't understand the economic forces, you don't understand what it means to be the nation that is the greatest debtor nation of all time. And, of course, what is going to happen to our dollar, what's going to happen to the future of our children, why, of course, you're not going to be able to prepare yourself. Let me recommend Joan's letters. And, again, the number to call is 301-371-0541. There's the women's group, there is the UN letter, and then there's the regular economic letter. So go ahead, Joan.
Now, with regard to the World Economic Forum, we have this very large group of very powerful people who have succumbed to an international agenda of world government. Of course, they think they're doing good, but, broad is the path and narrow is the way that leads to destruction. I would say with regard to this year's theme for the World Economic Forum, which was about making hard choices, that as I have researched some of the things that are going on right now besides global taxation, let me go back to global taxation for a minute. Jacques Chirac put global tax. They're now calling for Americans to ante up $55 billion a year. The British Finance Minister Gordon Brown has suggested something called an International Financing Facility, the IFF. And, of course, the two other leaders from France and Germany gave their consent and said it was a wonderful idea and concept. What is it? Well, actually, I think it'll be pretty close to an international central bank from the standpoint that it will take the promises of the United States the next 10 years to ante up that $55 billion, as well as the promises from the other G7 countries, and using those promises, they will go into the international bond market and leverage those promises in the international bond market to get through 30-year international bonds to get all, quote-unquote, this money for Africa.
Who is going to pay the interest on these 30-year bonds?
You and I.
Okay.
In perpetuity.
In perpetuity. And, of course, one more nail in the coffin of our republic, because we're going deeper and deeper into debt. And, of course, there's no instance in all history where a nation has gone into a fiat money system and that nation has survived. And they know that this one's not going to survive. And they know that out of the chaos that's going to follow its collapse will come the demand for the New World Order, the New World Religion. And, Joan, somebody had called in and wanted to know what the religious groups were that were in attendance at the forum.
Actually, you can, I don't have the list exactly in front of me, but the bottom line is you can go through. It was led by the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Clifton, Lord Carey of Clifton. There were different Rainbow Coalition thing.
Okay, go ahead.
With regard to the International Financing Facility, I find this extremely heinous, again from the standpoint that they're going to take our pledges of future income streams and leverage it. The bottom line is the cost to meet the United Nations Millennium Development Goals is at $50 billion a year. Well, I have a column to the Earth Institute, because the bottom line is if America antes up another $55 billion, in essence, why do all the other countries have to give? or why do we have to give this much?
And of course, if they go out and borrow the money based upon a promise to give and the United States can't pay the money, then what do you do?
Oh, that's right. I mean, you know, are we going to be transferring our force just like the third world countries are?
Well, I think this is really what is going to happen, because the plan is to make America a third world country, and anybody who doubts that needs to get a copy of the Earth Charter. You can get it up on the internet, or you can get one from us by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and read point 10 that talks about redistribution of wealth within nations and redistribution of wealth between nations. So we're going to transfer our wealth to other nations and raise our living standards to that of the Bolivian peasant. They know what they're doing, but if they told the American people that they're going to steal their wealth and their pensions and their future and their children's future, the people would rise up. And so they're going to do it slowly, just gradually, gradually lowering our living standards, gradually destroying the value of our currency, gradually destroying the value of our savings and our bonds and our annuities and our CDs, until one day we wake up and find that we are totally impoverished and a third world nation. That is exactly what our leaders want, because their loyalty is not to the United States, but to this internationalist dream, the New World Order, the New World Religion. Go ahead, Joan.
It almost sounds utopian, doesn't it?
No, it
Communism
really does.
At its finest. It's really international communism.
Well, that's why Gorbachev is in favor of it. That's why Maurice Strong and Stephen Rockefeller are working with Gorbachev, the communist. That's why, of course, Fidel Castro meets with his boss, David Rockefeller, back in 1995, why he was over here meeting, 95 or 96, and it comes right out of David Rockefeller's memoirs. But you didn't hear about that from Rush Limbaugh, because he wouldn't want you to know that Fidel Castro, the wicked communist, is holding private meeting with the noble, altruistic David Rockefeller, one of the most wealthy men in the world. It's estimated that the holdings of the Rockefeller family are about $100 trillion. Why, they could pay off all of our debts tomorrow if they wanted to, but they're sure not going to. They're going to be lending us more and more money, and we're going to be totally indebted to them.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, speaking about David Rockefeller, when you look at the foundations and the Rockefeller foundations, the various different Rockefeller brothers and all the other foundations that have been set up since 1907, the bottom line is those monies were used to set up the kind of social engineering that we currently are in the middle of. And yet, French President Jacques Chirac, one of his ideas for global taxation was for everybody who has a lot of money to set up other foundations, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I thought, isn't that interesting? We had the first generation with the Rockefellers and the Scaifes and the Mellons and the Pews and the Carnegies, social engineering America and changing our course from the foundation of the Constitution to whatever they think is right in their own eyes, to now French President Jacques Chirac saying, oh, hey, everybody ought to get on the bandwagon like Bill and Melinda Gates. Well, hey, if you set up a foundation, that means you don't pay any tax on your income. You move everything into that foundation. And therefore, guess what? The tax receipts of America goes down, and the burden becomes greater on you and I. It's just another shift in burden and taxation.
Right.
So, you know, anyway, going back to feudalism, at one time I was pretty
well,
naive.
We're progressing towards feudalism, whichever way you want to go to. That's just the way we're headed, with ruling lords and then the common serfs. That's you and me.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I've written my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, in which I talked about Cecil Rhodes and the Royal Institute for International Affairs from a different viewpoint. Not having understood everything about Cecil Rhodes, but showing how Prince Charles and the British royal family are right smack dab in the middle of everything that's happening. So we have this, you know, when I wrote that book, I it was then that I realized, hey, we're back to feudalism. We're back to serfdom. And it's only gotten worse since then. I mean, in the last 10 years, think of the quality of living in America and how it's changing. I mean, in the last 5 years, property values have more than doubled almost all over the country. Now, and they say inflation is almost zero. Excuse me. I don't think so. I do not think so. So we have the overseas development assistance. We have global taxation. I think that's how it's going to come in through the back door. With regard to the other items that the that were evident at the World Economic Forum, in December, the United Nations released a new report. They always have constant reports. This is another new report on the reform of the United Nations. And in that report, which will be the topic of discussion for their meeting, the opening of the General Assembly in September, which will be a five-year follow-up to the Millennium Summit in 2000, where they agreed that for the 21st century, the United Nations needed to have a greater goal and purpose. And so in 2000, the United Nations agreed to reduce poverty and starvation in the world by 50%. They agreed to give every kid in the world a basic primary education and a number of things. And so the cost for these goals is $50 billion a year, which that figure I mentioned a little bit earlier. Now, the United Nations Millennium Development Goals really is something that people need to understand, because I believe in the not-too-distant future they're going to be getting requests from their own employer to give to the United Nations to help fund these Millennium Development Goals, which, by the way, just happen to be based on all the starvation in the war-torn countries of Africa. Which brings us to, doggone, the British royal family again. When you look at, and I've written a book, written a report on the Commonwealth, and people... I talk about my research Britain decolonized over 40 countries, most of them in Africa. Thank you.
federal government. And of course, although Cecil Rhodes did. United Nations, working through private to public. The nation of free men.
Interestingly enough, the undercurrent at the World Economic Forum supported everything that was in the report of the UN for the reform of the UN. Surprise, surprise. So the CEOs have already been inundated on the next step, which is this new reform of the United Nations. So, hey, look, let's not get carried away and say, oh, hey, the rapture's coming. Let's dig in our heels and live for today and work to help people understand what's happening, to support those of us who are helping you to understand what's happening and to get involved. The life of your children and our freedom is at stake. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, then guess what? You're not worth your salt.
Well, let's go ahead and get the telephone number out again to help people get in touch with you.
My number is 301-371-0541.
One more time.
301-371-0541.
And how about an address if they want to write?
P.O. Box 77, Middletown. One word, Middle.
I'm going to go to the next one.
National Security Advisor who got us involved in Vietnam, but he makes it very clear in the forum. Thank you.